91 FM. With me now is writer Joe McGinnis, who got his start in Philadelphia, first as a reporter for the Bulletin, then as a columnist for the Inquirer. He left the Inquirer to write his book about the packaging of presidential candidate Richard Nixon, titled The Selling of the President 1968, which became a national bestseller. His new book, Fatal Vision, is about the case of Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, a physician and former Green Beret officer, who in 1970 was accused of the stabbing and bludgeoning death of his pregnant wife and two children at their home in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. McDonald suffered a couple of bruises and an ice pick puncture of the lung. He claimed that a group of Manson-type drug-crazed hippies attacked him. While he was disabled, he said, they killed his family. The Army could find no evidence that outsiders broke into his house. They wanted to try McDonald for the murder. They suspected he punctured his own lung to create an alibi, but charges were dismissed for lack of evidence. McDonald's in-laws, who first believed in his innocence, later became convinced of his guilt. They succeeded several years later in having the case reopened, and by this time McDonald was a wealthy Southern California doctor with a flashy apartment. In 1979, McGinnis picked up on the story. He negotiated book rights with McDonald, then moved in with him for the duration of the trial. McDonald was found guilty and is now serving three consecutive life sentences. McGinnis spent the next 4 years or so after McDonald's conviction trying to find a motive for the murder, continuing research for the book and then writing the book. McGinnis last joined us on Fresh Air after the publication of his book about Alaska, Going to Extremes. His new book, Fatal Vision, is published by Putnam. By the way, if you'd like to meet him, he will be having a book signing at Sessler's Bookstore at 5 o'clock this afternoon, and Sessler's is located at 1308 Walnut Street. Joe McGinnis, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be back.
What appealed to you about this case?
The first thing that made me think that it might be something worth writing about was the element of time. When I met Jeffrey McDonald, as you say, it was the summer of 1979. This was 9.5 years after the murders of his wife and children. And it just struck me immediately that this was a unique situation. Without knowing anything about the possibility of, probability of his being guilty or innocent, either way, here was a man who 9.5 years after this most tragic event that can occur in anyone's life, was going to be called back to face charges that he had committed the murders himself. Almost 10 years had passed. A decade had gone by. He had built, as you say, this extraordinarily successful new life in California. He had put all this behind him. 3,000 miles away, he left it there. And now he was going to have to go back and face it again. You know, was he a killer who, despite outward appearances to the contrary, had, you know, bludgeoned, stabbed his pregnant wife and two little girls to death on one night in February of 1970, and had then successfully concocted a cover story and had gone on to live a guilt-free, remorse-free life for almost 10 years? Or was he, as he maintained, an innocent victim of a judicial system run amok, a judicial system which was operating at the whim of his crazed father-in-law, who in such an obsessive quest for vengeance was willing to destroy McDonald's life and wouldn't rest until he'd seen Jeffrey McDonald convicted. I didn't know which of these two possibilities would turn out to be the reality, but I did know that the notion of somebody having to face something that tragic and terrible with those implications from so long ago, the passage of 9.5 years, it just showed how the power that the past has to reach out and claim us. You know, how we are not really free from our own past, no matter how much time and space we put between us and the past.
What kind of arrangement or deal did you make with McDonald before actually moving in with him? I know you talked about the book rights, and what did you work out?
Yeah, he had, the first time that I met him, which I was planning at that point only to write a brief article. I was serving as the writer-in-residence at the Los Angeles Herald Examiner at the time, and I had read this article in the newspaper that the Long Beach Police Officers Association was going to hold a fundraising dinner and disco dance to raise money for his defense. And again, it struck me as odd that cops would be raising money for a guy who was convicted, or not convicted, but accused of triple homicide. And went down to talk to him, and it became apparent during this first conversation that he was very interested in having somebody write a book about the case. And he said he had incurred horrendous legal expenses over the previous 10 years, and he was interested in having a book written that would finally tell the truth about what had happened, and also would help to give him funds with which to repay some of these legal fees. His lawyer was a man who had made quite a reputation here in Philadelphia in the late 60s and early 70s, Bernard Siegel, who was then practicing and is now practicing still in San Francisco. I was interested in two things. I was interested in complete access to him, to McDonald, throughout the duration of the trial and afterward. McDonald had exclusive access to the transcript of the original 1970 military hearing, which had been closed to the public. He also had access to the grand jury testimony of anybody who was going to be called as a witness against him in the criminal trial in 79. Normally, grand jury material is not available to a writer or to the public. So he could provide me with these things. Plus, I wanted to actually live with him during the course of the trial with no doors closed. I wanted to see how Siegel ran this, this thing from a strategic and tactical point of view. I wanted to see what unfolded day after day. I had no idea whether the guy was innocent or guilty, although I was certainly willing to presume innocence the way the jury would later be instructed to. The other thing that I required was complete freedom to tell the story any way that I wanted to. I insisted that he sign a legal release absolving me from any possible future action on grounds of libel or invasion of privacy or anything else whatsoever. And in return for this, his lawyer, Siegel, negotiated with my agent an arrangement which wound up essentially being that he would receive 25% of the profits that or the income that I would derive from the book up to a certain point, and then 33% thereafter.
Were you satisfied with that? Because say he turned out as he did to convince you that he was actually the murderer, it means that your book, if it does well, is going to profit the murderer. Does that disturb you at all?
Well, it doesn't disturb me because without this book, the truth would never have been told. To me, the opportunity to tell the truth was the primary consideration. I figured from the beginning, if he were innocent, I begrudged him this a little bit because I don't like anybody making money off work that I do. He wasn't going to give me a share of the proceeds from every operation he performed, I'm a professional writer, and on the other hand, he did have, a certain circumstance which made him, gave him a certain right, I suppose, to ask for some kind of arrangement like this. And I felt if he were guilty, he would be convicted. He would be in prison, as indeed he is today, and the money was not going to be of any use to him whatsoever. Without this arrangement, this book would never have been written. With this book never having been written, the public would know a lot less about Jeffrey McDonald and a lot less about what happened to Colette and Kimberly and Kristen, his wife and daughters, than they do now. They would know a lot less about the way our legal system can function and malfunction. They would know a lot less about certain pathological states of mind. My obligation, I felt from the beginning, was to the truth, whatever it would turn out to be. And if these were the necessary conditions, then I was willing to accept them.
Can you tell us the story of what happened that night, the night of the murders, the way McDonald told it to you?
He said that at about midnight on a Monday in February of 1970, his wife, who was 5 months pregnant, had come home from an adult education class. She had gone to Skidmore for 2 years and had dropped out when she became pregnant, and the two of them married. He had been in Princeton at the time. She had come back from this class. She had watched a Bob Hope special with him on television, the start of the Johnny Carson show, and then she had they had drunk a liqueur together on the couch and had talked quietly about the events of the day, and then she had gone on to bed. He had stayed up to watch the end of Johnny Carson. Then he had finished the last 50 pages of a Mickey Spillane novel he was reading, something called Kiss Me Deadly. Then, he said, still not being tired, he had decided to wash the dinner dishes because Colette used to have to face, she used to hate to have to face the dishes in the morning if they hadn't been done the night before. And since she was pregnant and tired, he would be a good guy and wash the dishes at 2 o'clock in the morning. And at that point, he went in to go to bed, and he found that his younger daughter, Kristen, aged 2.5, had gone into the master bedroom, had climbed into their bed, was asleep in the bed with his wife, but she had wet the bed. And so, he said, he picked Kristen up and carried her back to her own room, and then went back, and rather than face the prospect of lying down in wet sheets or the alternative prospect of waking up Colette and remaking the whole bed at 2:30 in the morning, he just grabbed a blanket and went back out to the living room couch and lay down and fell asleep. And at some point thereafter, he didn't know how much time had passed, he was awakened by the screams of his wife yelling, "Jeff, Jeff, why are they doing this to me?" And by the sound of his older daughter, Kimberly, screaming, "Daddy, Daddy, 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 Daddy." He tried to sit up, and as soon as he began to sit up from the couch, he said immediately, he was beset by, set upon by a group of four intruders. The description varied a bit in the early tellings, but it came down to be two white men, one black man, and a girl, a young woman with long blonde hair, who stood in the background holding a candle, chanting, "Acid is groovy, kill the pigs," while the white man and the black man assaulted him with knife, ice pick, and club. He struggled against them. He was finally knocked unconscious. When he regained consciousness, the house was quiet, dark, and empty. He got up and went down the hall, and he said he went from room to room and found the bodies of his wife, who had been stabbed more than 30 times and who had been had her skull fractured by a club. He found the body of his 5-year-old daughter in her bed. She'd been stabbed 8 to 10 times in the neck and had her skull fractured and her cheekbone fractured with a club. And he found the body of his younger daughter, Kristen, who had been stabbed with a knife and ice pick more than 30 times through the chest and back. At this point, he said he attempted to revive them with mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, saw that it wasn't working, went to the telephone, called the military police for help, stumbled back down the hallway, and when the military police arrived at about 3:50 a.m. on February 17th, 1970, they found him lying, apparently unconscious, right next to his wife with one arm around her, as one of the MPs put it, just like with a girlfriend, one arm wrapped around her very tight. That's the story that he told. The word pig in her blood, in the blood of Jeffrey McDonald's wife, was found written on the headboard of the bed in letters 8 inches high, just as 6 months earlier the word pig had been written on the headboard of Sharon Tate's bed in Beverly Hills by the members of the Manson cult. And the similarities between his story of these intruders in the night and the Manson cult murders of 6 months before were remarkably striking to investigators who first began to look into this, especially when they learned that over the weekend that immediately preceded the murders, McDonald had been reading and talking extensively about an Esquire magazine article about the Manson killings, in which very many details, of which would later form the basis of the story he told, were described.
After that explanation, why was the Army considering pressing charges against him? What was it about that scene that implicated him?
The first thing that didn't look right to the Army detectives who came to the house was that he said there had been this brutal struggle in the living room between himself and these four intruders. If we leave the girl in the background simply chanting and holding the candle, then there are still three guys with weapons, and he's fighting them off. They knock him unconscious. Well, there were no signs of such a struggle in the living room where he said it had taken place. A coffee table was turned on its side. A flower pot was knocked over. That was it. There were no other signs of struggle. As one of the chief of Army detectives said, he'd been in poker games that had left premises in worse condition than that. On a very unstable cabinet in the dining area, only 10 feet away, greeting cards, Valentine's cards, were still standing up on edge. They hadn't even been knocked over. Closer examination revealed that, despite the fact McDonald said he had been so badly wounded and injured by these people, there was no blood in the living room where the struggle had occurred. And then further evidence, as they began to investigate in more detail, They noted the fact, for example, that each member of the MacDonald family had a different blood type. Now, this was an extremely significant finding. Without this, I think they would never have been able to make any kind of a case against Jeffrey MacDonald. And at the time that he committed the murders, he would have had no way of knowing what blood types each of his family members had. People think, well, he was a doctor, he must have known, but I've talked to a lot of doctors, and very few doctors don't know the blood types of their own family members. I don't know the blood types of my daughters. I don't think I even know my own blood type. It's just not something that people pay much attention to. By chance, it turned out that each member of this family had a different blood type. It was therefore possible for the Army investigators to reconstruct who had bled where in that apartment. And this reconstruction was totally at variance with the story that Jeffrey MacDonald told. Also totally at variance was the fact that he himself had been wounded so slightly. Why did he have wounds that did not even require a single stitch to close, the superficial knife cuts, scratch marks on his chest where an MP said it looked like somebody had scratched with her fingernails? Why did these ghostly intruders who had selected weapons for this massacre from the MacDonald house, they had must have walked into the house, tiptoed down the hallway into the kitchen, found two kitchen knives and an ice pick. These are all items that belonged in the MacDonald house. They commit the murders with these weapons, and then they place them carefully just outside the back door before vanishing into the night. It just didn't add up. It didn't make sense. The entire pattern was much more consistent with someone who would have committed these murders himself and then would have invented this cover story to try to escape blame.
But they didn't have enough evidence.
Well, they mishandled, in the early stages, they mishandled a great deal of the evidence. The military policemen who were sent to the scene were very young and inexperienced, and the scene was one of such carnage, such ghastly horror, that the first photographer called to the scene had to leave because he was getting sick to his stomach as he tried to take pictures. I mean, you know, these little girls awash in blood in their beds, and this woman who was just so horrendously just massacred. I mean, this was something that even hardened investigators couldn't cope with. And so mistakes were made. They let the garbage men come the next morning and empty the trash without ever checking to see if any evidence had been disposed of there. Some sloppy work was done in terms of fingerprinting. A whole series of errors was made, but the thing that caused the Army to drop the charges against MacDonald several months later after a four-month hearing, one was the aggressive defense launched by Mr. Siegel, the counsel from Philadelphia, who pointed out all the Army blunders and who also had the testimony of a Philadelphia area psychiatrist, a man from Jenkintown, actually, named Robert Sadoff, who took the stand and said that in his opinion, having examined Captain MacDonald and having analyzed the psychological testing that was done at Norristown State Hospital, it was his opinion that this man did not have the capacity to have committed crimes of this sort. That was very persuasive testimony to the Army hearing officer. MacDonald himself makes a wonderful impression on people. He seems so sincere. He seems so persuasive. And he acted just so contrite and so, not contrite, but just so grief-stricken as he testified at this military hearing that at the conclusion of it, the hearing officer said he felt that there was no reason to proceed with any further charges. Now, my personal, more cynical view 10 years later is that the Army in 1970 just didn't want to face the public spectacle of a court-martial of a Green Beret officer for having murdered his own wife and children. They already had Lieutenant Calley to contend with. They had the war going badly. The Army image was bad enough. They just, I think, wanted to say, look, let's just get rid of this guy. Let's get him out of the Army and let the civilian prosecutors pick it up. And when they finally do come up with a case against him, if they do, at least they won't be calling him a Green Beret officer anymore. So by December of 1970, he received an honorable discharge. And if he had kept his mouth shut and just gone quietly on his way, I think he'd still be a free man today, sailing on his yacht and driving his sports car and performing emergency medicine in California. But he wasn't satisfied with that. He had to use this then as a vehicle that would carry him toward fame, if not fortune. From the very beginning, he was interested in having somebody write his story. While still locked up under military guard at Fort Bragg, he was writing letters to Robert Sherrill, to John Sack, to other authors saying, wouldn't you be interested in telling the story of me, the courageous Green Beret who was falsely accused of these charges? When finally freed, almost the first thing he did was to appear on the Dick Cavett Show, national television, and talk about how mistreated he had been by Army investigators. He went on for 20 minutes without ever mentioning the horror that had befallen his wife and children until finally he said this has been such a terrible nightmare for me. And finally Cavett had to interject, and I guess it was also kind of a nightmare for your wife and children. He said, oh, yes, you know, that too, of course. But the whole emphasis was on himself and how he had suffered. And during the course of that broadcast, he made the statement that he had sustained 18 stab wounds in this attack upon him. One of the people watching that broadcast was his father-in-law, Colette MacDonald's stepfather, actually, who had been MacDonald's staunchest supporter, his most outspoken advocate. During that military hearing, Colette MacDonald's stepfather said, if I ever had another daughter, I would still want the same son-in-law. This was a man who believed passionately in the innocence of Jeffrey MacDonald. He's sitting at home watching the Dick Cavett program, and he hears MacDonald talk about the 18 stab wounds. Well, he knew from having been at the hospital at Fort Bragg the day of the murders that there were no 18 stab wounds. There were no stab wounds. There were three superficial stab wounds. There was a partial collapse of one lung caused by a wound that could very easily have been self-inflicted, it was later determined. But he said, my goodness, why is the man telling a lie like this? If he would tell a lie like this, what other lies might he have told? One other lie he did tell was when the father-in-law began saying, you know, we're going to have to go out and track down these people. I want to find out who was responsible. I want to get at the people who did this thing. Jeffrey MacDonald, who knew that these people did not exist, he knew that the father-in-law nor no federal agent nor anyone would ever find them since they weren't there, made up a story, told his father-in-law in a telephone conversation, which the father-in-law taped and then gave me the tape, and the transcript of the tape is actually in Fatal Vision, a portion of it. He said that he had gone out with some Green Beret friends, had tracked down one of this band of intruders, and had killed them, had beaten the truth out of him, had got a complete confession, and then had murdered him. He said, one down, three to go. He said that in a taped telephone conversation. Well, several months later, the father-in-law determined that this was not true. No such thing had ever occurred. And by that time, he had gotten access to the transcript of MacDonald's testimony at this closed military hearing, and he had found dozens of inconsistencies, dozens of things of which he simply knew to be untrue. And at that point, he changed his mind and said, you know, as awful as it is to contemplate this, the fact is that this Jeffrey MacDonald, who I have known since he was 12 years old, he himself and he alone murdered Colette and Kimberly and Kristen.
And that's when he tried to get the case reopened.
That's when he did. The Army was already, in response again to MacDonald's demands, MacDonald on the Dick Cavett Show accused Army investigators of committing perjury during the Article 32 hearing. Well, the Army, in response to that, opened an investigation into the investigators, and after several weeks concluded that they had not been guilty of any misfeasance or malfeasance, but then they were given the mandate to continue the investigation, and right away it came right back again to Jeffrey MacDonald. The evidence still continued to point to him, and the father-in-law, in cooperation with them, over the next 2 years, developed a case which was presented to the Justice Department in 1972, and then the Justice Department said, we don't want anything to do with this. This guy is just he's just too hard. It'll be too hard a case to win. It's not worth the manpower. On a cost efficiency basis, it's not worth it to try to go after this guy. That's where the father-in-law wouldn't quit. If it had not been for the father-in-law's persistence, and his name is Alfred Kassab, and he works for the Quality Egg Company in Dayton, New Jersey, selling carload lots of liquid egg yolk to manufacturers of macaroni and mayonnaise. But in World War II, he had been a Canadian Army intelligence agent, and he was a very determined man. And he said, yes, he was very obsessed with finding—he knew he had found the killer, very obsessed with seeing justice done. This was almost an aspect that gave it the nature of a Greek tragedy. He was going to haunt this man down through the years. He wasn't going to let him escape from the past. And the single-minded quest for vengeance is what finally caused a grand jury to be convened in 1974. MacDonald was called to testify before the grand jury. At the end of his testimony, when he was called back the second time, it was January of 1975, he wound up shouting obscenities at the prosecutor, telling him what he could do with his so-called evidence. By then, the grand jurors were convinced that there was certainly cause for indictment. He was indicted in 1975. For 4 years, Bernard Siegel, the attorney, maneuvered legally and quite properly to try to have the indictment dismissed, claiming such things as violation of Sixth Amendment right to speedy trial, claiming double jeopardy because the original hearing had resulted in a dropping of charges. The Supreme Court eventually in both instances ruled that Siegel's claims were without merit or foundation, and in July of 1979, the case finally came to trial 9.5 years after the murders.
Joe McGinnis is my guest, if you're just joining us, and his new book about the subject he's discussing is called Fatal Vision. In 1979, when the case actually came to trial again, as you mentioned, there were benefits on his behalf. There was like a Friends of Dr. Jeffrey McDonald group that had formed for $100 a plate dinners for his defense fund. What did his friends out there know about the case and about its reopening? How informed were they?
They knew only what he told them, which was that his alcoholic maniac of a father-in-law had somehow pressured the Justice Department into keeping these charges alive, and that mid-level bureaucrats in the Justice Department were trying to advance their careers at his expense, and that he was just a terribly beleaguered individual. And these people had worked with him side by side professionally in the case of doctors and nurses, and the hospital administrators thought the world of him. The Long Beach police, for whom he would work long hours, surgically saving the lives of policemen injured in the line of duty and socializing with these people. These people over the years had come to think of Jeffrey McDonald as very much a heroic figure. And they never did have any access to the facts of the case, because none of the facts of the case until the trial itself, none of the facts were in the public domain. The Army hearing in 1970 had been closed. The grand jury, of course, had been a private proceeding. All they knew was that the man had been indicted. And saying that a man is presumed innocent until proven guilty, they were well within their rights, I think, in terms, morally and ethically in every way, in being so staunch in their defense of him. I think it's a little harder to justify their position now when the facts have become such common knowledge, or certainly are available if anybody wants to take the time and trouble either to look through the court records or now in this case even just to read the book. But there are still those people, and some of your listeners may have seen some of them on 60 Minutes a week or so ago, who believe to this day, all facts notwithstanding, that Jeffrey McDonald is such a wonderful person that, as Dr. Sadoff said in 1970, he could not possibly have done this thing, no matter what the physical evidence indicates.
His lawyer, Bernie Siegel, gave him advice, and some of the advice I found really interesting. Typical, not to wear polyester or beachy colors or be Southern California looking. But then he said, look serious, look reliable, and look burdened.
That struck me. This was a letter that Siegel wrote to McDonald just before the beginning of the trial in 1979. And it struck me as something so inappropriate that you would have to tell a client to look burdened when he's on trial for the murder of his wife and children. Yet, having come to know McDonald and having watched McDonald the way he operates and reacts, it was advice that he really needed to be given, because there's a very inappropriate aspect to his reaction to certain events. The whole trial was conducted more like a political campaign with Jeff as the candidate than a murder trial with Jeff as the defendant. There was this atmosphere of, we got to go out there and win this one, but there was no sense of sadness. These victims, Colette and these two children, it was like they had never lived. It was like the whole thing was just Jeff on one side and these prosecutors on the other side, and it was just like one of the touch football games that he would play with the Long Beach police. Let's win this one. It's an important one. But it was that kind of competitive atmosphere. I found it very peculiar. And it was the kind of thing where, Siegel had to keep stressing, Jeff, you can't start looking too chipper in court, because, the jury needs to see you appearing, burdened, somber. And also you have to at least, insofar as your looks go, he wrote in that same letter, appear truthful, because truthfulness was one of Jeffrey's problems. He's been caught in many, many, many lies over the years, and Siegel wanted him to at least appear to be the kind of person who would be telling the truth, because when the time came for him to take the stand and tell his own story again, it would be the single most important moment of the trial. If the jury were to believe him, you know, all the evidence could get washed right out the window. In fact, just the opposite happened. His testimony seemed so blatantly and transparently false that despite 9.5 years to prepare for it, it left the jury in a position where they took only 6.5 hours of deliberation to find him guilty on 2 counts of second-degree murder, where they felt Colette and the older child had been killed in an initial burst of rage, and then 1 count of first-degree murder, where they accepted the government contention that in order to save himself, in order to manufacture this cover story, and also because she had been an eyewitness to the final assault on her mother, it was going to be necessary for Jeffrey to go into the bedroom of his 2.5-year-old daughter, Kristen, and stab her 30 times in the chest and back with ice pick and knife. It's a horrible thing to have to contemplate, but the jury was able to look the facts in the eye and not blink, and they did, in fact, find him guilty on all 3 counts.
Can you just sum up for us some of the other evidence that got him that conviction? You mentioned the different blood types and the fact that there was virtually nothing overturned in the living room where he insisted that a fight had taken place.
Yeah, a major piece of evidence was the pajama top that he had been wearing that night. When the pajama top was first found, it was lying on the chest of his wife, who was lying on her back on the bedroom floor. His pajama top was draped across her chest. He said that the pajama top had been pulled over his head during his struggle with the intruder, and he had used it as a shield to try to fend off their blows. And then after regaining consciousness, he had torn it from his wrists and dropped it on her chest to try to keep her warm, sort of a reflexive gesture. Well, there were 48 ice pick holes found in the pajama top when it was finally examined. And, of course, there were no ice pick holes in Jeffrey McDonald, save possibly the one which was self-inflicted and caused the partial collapse of the lung. Those 48 ice pick holes, when the pajama top was refolded in the same position that it had been found on top of his wife's chest, the 48 holes through the fabric of that pajama top lined up in an almost perfect constellation with the 21 ice pick holes in Colette McDonald's chest, proving or indicating very strongly that someone had stabbed her through the pajama top with an ice pick after she had already come to rest on the floor. According to his story, the intruders and the ice pick were long gone from the house by the time he tore the pajama top off his wrists. Therefore, how could these 48 holes in the pajama top match up with the 21 holes in her chest? Not if his story were true, but if he had put the pajama top on her chest and then had stabbed her through the pajama top, that would account for the similarity. If you take these few examples and multiply them by 20 or 30 or 40, you will have some idea of the extensiveness of the physical evidence and how thoroughly it contradicted the story he told.
Joe McGinnis is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Fatal Vision, which is a study of the case of Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, who is now serving 3 consecutive life sentences for the murder of his pregnant wife and 2 children. You've tried to discover what motive he would have had for doing this. What did you come up with?
Well, I think there are 2 things. One is that despite this surface appearance of being the all-American boy and having he most popular, most likely to succeed, I mean, just everything on the surface, not very far beneath that surface, there's a great deal of psychological instability. I believe him to be suffering from a personality disorder, which is currently described in psychiatric literature as pathological narcissism, which does not just mean grandiosity or an overly inflated opinion of oneself, but is a when used clinically, it describes a personality disorder which has at its root an almost boundless repressed rage against the female sex, a confusion of one's wife with one's mother, and it stems from early in childhood, and is the result of basically an upbringing where you are loved not for who you are or what you are, but only for what you have achieved. You are, as Alice Miller has written in a brilliant book called Prisoners of Childhood. She's a German psychiatrist. This book has just been reissued in paperback called The Drama of the Gifted Child. The narcissistic mother teaches the child that he can gain love only by displaying a false self, only by being the kind of person that will satisfy her needs rather than being his own individual. One of the patients described in this book explains the syndrome as having to walk around on stilts all the time in order to be better than everybody else, in order to be higher than everybody else. Well, if you walk around on stilts all the time, you gradually develop intense envy of and rage toward those who are free to walk around on their own 2 feet, which is much easier to do. Those who are free to be average. Jeffrey was never free to be average. So I think this personality configuration left him susceptible to this kind of rage. And I know for a fact, because I read it in his own handwriting in notes I discovered while living in his apartment after his conviction, that during the 3 weeks that preceded the murders, he, already a physically fit paratroop-trained Green Beret officer who had just finished working out with the Fort Bragg boxing team for a month, in those 3 weeks before the murders, he lost 15 pounds while taking a diet pill called Escitrol, which contains amphetamine, which, if taken in sufficient quantity, is capable of triggering a psychotic rage reaction. And in notes that he wrote before he discovered that the Army had neglected to test his blood for the presence of amphetamines, he described how on the night of the murders he quite possibly had taken one of these pills and that he had been taking them over the preceding weeks. And in reading extensively in medical literature about this drug, which incidentally has been taken off the market by its manufacturer due to adverse side effects such as rage reaction, it's the kind of thing that can cause temporary insanity. The only time he was ever given a polygraph test, it was in the privacy of his own lawyer's office here in Philadelphia, and the man who was called in to give the examination emerged saying, "I recommend that Captain McDonald plead temporary insanity." So we have an unstable personality taking a drug which can trigger psychotic rage reaction. We have a deeply repressed rage against the female sex. We have the murder of a woman and 2 daughters, no sons, although the child that was not born would have been, ironically, a son. And we have the man for 13 years saying he didn't do it.
Do you think he believes he didn't do it?
No, I don't think he believes he didn't do it, because I think if he believes he didn't do it, I don't think he would have waited, for example, 9.5 years until he was in prison himself before first employing a private detective to try to go out and try and find the people who did do it. I don't think he would have resisted as hard as he did, as long as he did, the opportunity to take a test to be questioned about this while under the influence of sodium amytal. This is not really truth serum, but it is a memory-enhancing drug, a relaxing drug, which might cause things that had been suppressed or repressed to come to the consciousness. It might have improved his ability to recall the events of that night, which would have aided investigators in their search for these 4 hippies. If he thought they were out there, I think he would have really gone out and helped his father-in-law and investigators look for them rather than make up this cock and bull story about how he himself had gone out and killed one of them. But by knowing they were never there, he knew they were never going to be found, and therefore he made no attempt for 9.5 years to even employ anyone to go out and look for them. Only when he was in prison himself did he begin to care about that aspect.
I think one of the things I find so disturbing about this story is the thought that someone in a very respectable position who's been very successful, who has lots of friends, can actually be a killer and has the potential for that, and betrays none of that in his personality. And certainly when you met him, you didn't think, oh boy, this is a guy who's obviously a murderer, he's really weird. I mean, he didn't betray any of that.
Not
to you
at all,
either.
Quite the contrary. He seemed like, you know, like a terribly nice guy. He was very good company throughout the entire course of the trial. I enjoyed running around the track with him, drinking beer with him, eating pizza with him, talking about baseball, browsing in bookstores, you know, just real good company, a real nice guy. And this is one of the scary things, and I think it's what gives this case a particularly haunting aspect, which has kept it on the fringes of the public consciousness for so many years. Just what is that line that makes him different from me, for example, from anybody else? Why is Jeffrey McDonald over there capable of doing this? And why am I over here without that capacity? Or does everyone have that capacity? You know, most psychiatric professionals would say no, everyone does not have that capacity. But when you get them to try to define the line, you know, why is he on one side of it and the rest of us on another, it becomes very indistinct and blurred.
Have you found yourself evaluating people differently since undertaking this research?
Well, I don't know if I've evaluated people differently in general. I certainly come to question the role that I think psychiatric professionals should play in the judicial process, because with no disrespect intended for Dr. Sadoff, who I think is a very competent man and a very well-intentioned individual, it strikes me that on the basis of a three-hour examination and an analysis of one set of psychological tests, one battery of tests, to be able to make the flat-out statement that this man does not possess the capacity to have committed these crimes with the resultant behavior that he displayed, is to go a little bit too far. I think that psychiatric professionals, when dealing with criminal acts, have to be rather cautious in terms of assessing individual capacity. It's made me skeptical of aspects of our justice system. There were so many mistakes made. It's made me very, very cynical about the profession of the practice of criminal law. I have seen things done in this case, you know, on both sides, which I think were a violation of standards of ethics and the kind of professional behavior we'd like to think we would come to expect in a courtroom.
Can you give us an example of that?
Well, yes. During the grand jury on one side, for example, when there is no defense, when only the prosecutor, there's no prosecutor really because there's no defendant yet at a grand jury, nobody's been indicted, but clearly McDonald was a subject of this inquiry. After he completed his testimony one day and left the room, the attorney who was conducting the grand jury hearing began to joke with grand jurors about what they had just heard, began to talk about him behind his back, began to say, well, we could keep him here, we could bring him back next week, but he'll just tell us more lies. To begin to evaluate that kind of testimony, to make these kind of statements, I think is a clear violation of what he's entitled to do in front of a grand jury. On the other side, I think there's a tendency for criminal lawyers on the defense side of a major case which is attracting a great deal of national publicity to try to use the case perhaps to advance their own careers, to behave in a histrionic, attention-getting fashion which may, they think, serve their own best interests rather than the best interests of their clients. Bernie Siegel certainly made himself the focus of a lot of media attention during that trial in 1979, but in the end, it required only 6.5 hours for his client to be convicted.
We only have about 1 minute left, but I know he sent you, one of his scrapbooks, sent you a lot of the fan letters that he's been getting at prison. Can you tell us briefly what kind of mail that is? I've heard that people on trial for murders or even mass murders end up with a following, sometimes even groupies who show up at the trial.
There's a whole cult. There's a cult out there that is really worshiping this man. People from all over the country writing him letters. You know, it is the cliche, but it's true. Marriage proposals, religious fanatics who say that he'll always be in their prayers. People who say they know he couldn't possibly have done it. There are a lot of emotionally unstable people out there who lead such empty lives that I think they get some vicarious thrill out of a connection, however tangential, with somebody at the center of attention for something like this. And he's very good about responding to this and cultivating these people. And so he's in a very different way from Charles Manson, he's a very effective leader of his own cult.
Well, it's been really interesting hearing about the research that you've done over the past few years. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, it's better to talk about it than it was to write it. It was a hard book to write.
Did you get a lot of nightmares while you were doing
it? I lost a lot of sleep, especially between the hours of 3 and 4 a.m. I kept waking up that hour, night after night after night, for 3 years.
It's difficult material to deal with.
It was.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking with us. And Joe McGinnis has been my guest in his new book, which we've been discussing, about the case of Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, who's now in prison. It's called Fatal Vision, and Fatal Vision has just been published by Putnam. If you'd like to meet Joe McGinnis, he's on his way now to a book signing at Sessler's Bookstore, and that's located at 1308 Walnut Street in Philadelphia. And, of course, Philadelphians also know Joe McGinnis from his writing on the Bulletin and the Philadelphia Inquirer. In the 1960s, his other books include Going to Extremes, a recent book about Alaska, and The Selling of the President in 1968. And thanks again for being with us.
My pleasure.
It's 8 minutes to 5 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on 91 FM. Jane Voss and Hoyle Osborne, who have visited with us several times on Fresh Air, have a new album that's just come out. The album's called Pullin' Through. We're going to hear a selection from it called Hot Buttered Rum.